I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Back in June, the New York Times listed 83 environmental rules and regulations the Trump administration wants to eliminate, involving air pollution, water pollution, drilling and extraction, toxic substances, and more. Now, some have been rolled back and some are in process. One of those regs involves auto emission standards set by the Obama administration of 52.5 miles per gallon by 2025. The Trump administration wants to set the standard at 37 miles per gallon. Last week, Ford, BMW of North America, Volkswagen Group of America, and Honda agreed to abide by California's mileage standards, which are very close to the standard set by President Obama. This sets up an interesting and important fight between the federal government and the states over who establishes and enforces environmental policies. Joining us from the NPR studios in Culver City, California, is Jody Freeman. She's a professor of law, the founding director of the Harvard Law School Environmental and Energy Law Program. She served in the White House as counselor for energy and climate change in 2009-2010, where she was the architect of President Obama's agreement with the auto industry to double fuel efficiency standards. Jody Freeman, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Great to be with you.
So what is the significance of these four companies siding with California over the Trump administration? Do you think they did it for business reasons or for environmental reasons or a combination of the two?
Well, I'm sure each company has its own rationale, but it's in all of their interests, really, because what they're trying to do is settle the rules for moving forward and making cars, and they're waiting and waiting for the Trump administration, which has been saying it's going to roll back these fuel efficiency and greenhouse gas standards, and all they're doing is sowing confusion. And it's very hard to go about your business when the rules of the road are unclear. So I think they're trying to say, we'd like this resolved, please. And we don't want the severe rollback that the Trump administration is trying or threatening to put in place. And they're saying there's another pathway for us. And that's really what they were up to when they were making the deal with California. What they got out of it was a little more time to comply, a little bit weaker on the stringency of these fuel efficiency standards, not substantially weaker, but a little bit weaker. And they got a lot of credits, extra credits, if they build more fuel-efficient vehicles like in electric vehicles and such. So they got something out of this deal that makes it easier on them for a time, but they're still marching toward cleaner cars. They're still going to improve them year over year by about 3.7% compared to, say, 5% per year under the Obama approach.
They represent something like 30% of the U.S. auto market. It doesn't include General Motors or Toyota or Fiat Chrysler. Do you think that sets up some kind of a fight between the car companies?
Yeah, this is very interesting. Let me give you a little context on this. So the auto industry has historically always been united and dead set against climbing fuel efficiency standards. Their posture has always been to oppose the federal government trying to increase them. They've lobbied Congress hard against that historically. And they certainly have been wary about California because California has this unique power under the federal Clean Air Law. California alone can set its own vehicle standards because it's sort of been grandfathered in under the Clean Air Act, because historically California's air pollution was so bad that it was allowed to set its own car standards, and they could be more stringent than the federal standards. So that has always set up a dynamic where California has this outsized power to kind of drive forward on these standards, and states are allowed to copy California so they can opt in. And that has set up a kind of two-car nation, and the car companies have always kind of bristled at this idea that California alone gets to set the pace of this. Well, what the Obama team did was say, look, we don't want there to be confusion about this. We want to resolve this into a single federal standard, but we want to make it stringent enough that California will buy into it. And so they made a deal and set a sort of consistent standard that would improve the performance of every vehicle over time, make them all more efficient, whether they're the big SUVs or the smaller vehicles. And they said to the car companies, look, we're giving you one standard to meet. You don't have to worry about California doing something different. And this is going to be good for GHG reductions, that is good for greenhouse gases, good for regular old conventional air pollution reductions, and you've got certainty going forward. You don't have to wonder about this. So everybody bought into this. The whole industry signed up for this program. And what the Trump administration has threatened to do that's not yet final is freeze those standards, as you said, at the top of the program, freeze them so that they won't climb anymore after 2020. And instead of going up every year to 2025 and beyond, they're going to be frozen. And even the auto industry's reaction to this was, whoa, wait a minute. We didn't ask you for this. We like the structure from the Obama years. We don't want California now unhappy and setting their own standards. So, you know, what are you doing? You're going overboard. And that has really set the stage for what you just described, which is at least four companies, and crucially Ford, which is a leader and obviously a big domestic company, saying, you know what, we don't want this rollback, and going ahead and setting up their own deal with California, hoping the rest of the industry will say, well, we like this pathway too. What might happen is that some of the other companies will sit it out and wait and see whether the Trump administration really goes as far as they're threatening to go, and we could wind up in litigation over this with some of the industry on the side of the Trump rollback and some of the industry against it, which would be unique. We've never seen a split like that in the auto industry, so we will see how this unfolds.
It seems that California also, because there's so many people that live there, there's so much demand in California that in many ways I can understand the kind of clout they have in this kind of argument.
Yes, they've always played this very important leadership role, not just because of market share, but because California is sort of the leading air pollution regulator among the states and always has been, and they've established their expertise and their credibility. And it's an accomplishment, a real accomplishment of, you know, officials in California, including Mary Nichols, who leads the air pollution regulatory agency there, and the governor and the attorney general, to really make this deal and say, look, here's an olive branch, you know, here's the pathway, and the rest of the car companies should sign up for this. I should say there's a potential problem here. Mm-hmm. This is a good start, and it represents, like you said, about 30% of the auto industry, about 30% of the market. But if you don't get the whole industry behind these stricter rules, then you're not going to get the air quality improvements and the greenhouse gas reductions that you really need to make progress. So it's a great opening deal, but it's not the end that anybody hopes for. And there's another risk here that some people may not realize, which is that this deal doesn't stop the Trump administration from going ahead and trying to freeze these standards federally. And part of their policy, part of what they're proposing, is to block California's power. So they've got a legal theory embedded in their proposal. These are the Trump folks at EPA. Their theory is that actually California doesn't have the legal power to set greenhouse gas standards for cars. And if they prevail on that, if they were to win on that, then the legal underpinning for this deal we're talking about, the leverage California has, would disappear.
A couple of questions. One, do you see this then ending up before the U.S. Supreme Court?
Well, it certainly could. I mean, I would project that if a few things happen. One is they have to finish. The Trump administration keeps saying it will finish this rollback and hasn't. They dismissed this California car company deal as a PR stunt, so it's not going to stop them. But it takes some time, and until they finish, there won't be litigation. There won't be a legal challenge. And once there's a legal challenge, it takes time to move through the courts, through the lower courts to the Supreme Court. It could take a year or even two. And by that time, we could be in a new administration. So a new administration could halt all of this and say, we're going to go back to the Obama approach, and we're going to keep moving forward on strict fuel efficiency standards and greenhouse gas standards. And so they could unravel the unraveling, if you will.
Well, as you say, and businesses want certainty, and that certainly puts a kind of a little wrinkle in that desire for certainty. But it's interesting. On the one hand, we see in the United States a demand for SUVs and pickup trucks. We also see companies, car companies, experimenting with electric cars and hybrid vehicles. And of course, we're talking about a global market on top of the American market. How does this all shake out?
Yeah, the global market does create demand for smaller vehicles, more fuel-efficient vehicles in different parts of the world, like Europe and all over the world, like India, where you need more affordable cars, and China. But the U.S. market's unique because Americans like to drive big cars.
Yes, we do.
You know, 65% of the market at this point is SUVs, or what they call light-duty trucks. And they're very profitable. So the auto industry wants to make the money, the extra money they make with these vehicles. But I think what's important is that, you know, Americans, I think, want these larger cars, but they also want clean air. And they also would like to do something about climate change. And it's actually possible to do these things all at the same time. And these standards are not about telling people what car to drive. You know, people make a mistake when they think that. These standards are about making sure every vehicle on the road, from your most efficient Honda or Toyota all the way through your F-150, gets more fuel efficient over time. And that's entirely possible. The technology is available. It's possible at an affordable price. There's no reason we can't have consumer choice and better fuel efficiency both at the same time.
Transportation, as I understand it, is the largest source of CO2 pollution. Is that correct?
That is correct, and growing, and that's what's so important. If we don't tackle greenhouse gas emissions from this part of the economy, the transportation sector, we're going to get further and further behind. And the best policy we've learned so far is, in fact, CAFE standards, what people know as those miles per gallon standards. They actually are a very effective policy for making cars more efficient over time. And they happen to also do other good things, you know, like they reduce our dependence on oil. And they save consumers money because they're more efficient. So they're kind of a win all round. And the federal government finally, in the Obama administration, redirected us in a way to get us sort of out of our stall on fuel efficiency and move us forward. And the Trump administration seems determined to move us backward.
I'm looking at something you wrote almost a year ago. It was August 2nd, 2018. So almost a year ago in the New York Times, where obviously we were at the very beginning of this conversation. But you talk about making it easier for industry to meet standards by rewarding companies for investing in advanced technologies like electric, hybrid, and autonomous vehicles, tinted windows, efficient lighting, and the like. I mean, how much do you think just some of these technological fixes will address the problem?
Yeah, I think they really make great progress. I mean, you can do all kinds of technological things that sound very nerdy, but they're actually really exciting. You can improve air conditioning. You can lightweight vehicles with super strong materials so that you don't compromise safety, but you lose a lot of the weight, which means you make a car move more quickly, more fuel efficiently. There's all this stuff you can do now, even with regular internal combustion engines. And then there's all the things you can do in the space that's hybrid and electric, where a lot of the car companies are experimenting now and claim they're going to produce more and more of these models. So I think there's a lot of innovation in the auto industry. I happen to be very optimistic about it. And I just don't accept the argument that we have to, you know, freeze standards in place and can't make any progress. I should underscore that the reason this matters is that unless you do something about greenhouse gas emissions from the parts of the economy that are producing the greatest share, unless you tackle it one by one, transportation emissions, emissions from electric power, from electricity sector, emissions from industry, from agriculture, from housing. Unless you have a plan to go sector by sector, you're not going to come up with a U.S. plan to do something about climate change.
Well, we're going to take a very short break and get back to our conversation. I do want to talk about electric power. You can join us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Jody Freeman, our guest, founding director of the Harvard Law School Environmental and Energy Law Program. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with Jody Freeman. She's a professor of environmental law at Harvard Law School. We've been talking about some of the efforts by the Trump administration to roll back environmental regulations. And Jody, you mentioned the Clean Power Plan or Electric Plan. The Trump administration wants to repeal the Clean Power Plan, which sets limits on carbon emissions from gas and coal-fired power plants. What's the challenge here? What's the status?
So this, to put it in context, is really, along with these car standards, really the pillars of the U.S. policy on climate change that the Obama administration embraced. So if you put these policies together, you get the heart of our pledge to the Paris Accord to reduce our emissions over time by up to 28% by 2025. And so these two policies are crucial. The electric power industry produces about a third of the country's greenhouse gas emissions. These are our oldest and dirtiest coal-fired power plants and our oldest natural gas plants. And what the Obama folks did is said, look, we see this fleet of old facilities, old power plants, and we want to make sure that there are some limits on the carbon pollution that they produce. So these were the country's first ever carbon pollution standards to try to limit the CO2 coming from the power sector. And it was a really creative policy that said, look, we look across the electricity grid and we see that it's interconnected, and we see that by dialing up cleaner kinds of power like wind power, solar power, and dialing down coal-fired power, we can clean up the grid and reduce our CO2 emissions, and by the way, reduce a lot of other pollution at the same time. So the Obama folks set the first ever standards, and the Trump administration essentially has decided to rescind that policy and put out a policy that would make almost no progress on reducing CO2 pollution. So again, it's a big retrenchment, moving backwards, holding back progress that the electricity grid is already capable of meeting, and preventing us really from meeting our Paris commitment. Remember, the president also announced withdrawing us from the Paris Accord. So he's announced that policy, and then he's unraveling the domestic policies that would have gotten us there. And just to give you a sense of what the difference is between the Trump policy on the electricity sector and the Obama policy, the Trump administration would essentially accomplish at best about a 1% improvement in our greenhouse gas emissions, a 1% reduction over time by 2030. The Obama folks would have reduced our CO2 pollution by almost 20%. So it's a really significant difference.
Let me ask you, though, about, and you mentioned some of these old coal coal-powered plants, also yeah. some of the old, I guess, natural gas plants. But I wonder whether they are, in a sense, going to be going out of business anyway, because you've got pressure coming from cheaper natural gas. We're here in Pennsylvania. There's a lot of natural gas in Pennsylvania. Even things like wind and solar, whether that will, in a sense, be the force that gets rid of some of these polluting plants.
It's true that some coal-fired power plants have been retiring. So maybe around 50 of them have retired since Trump was sworn into office. And I think they have on deck another 100 or so, 117 units, I think, that are planning to retire. So you're right, they will retire over time. The problem is the Trump administration has basically adopted policies that amount to life extension projects for those coal-fired power plants to keep them alive longer. So not only are they eliminating essentially any meaningful controls on CO2 pollution, which would help drive more of them to retirement sooner, but they're also adopting a policy that's very hard for people to see because it's so complicated. They're also proposing a policy that would let old plants update or renovate without installing the most modern pollution control. And that is really allowing for longer life for these coal-fired power plants. And that goes in the exactly wrong direction. That policy to allow the renovation of a plant without installing modern pollution controls is like a grandfathering in perpetuity. And that's bad for local air quality, but it's also terrible for the prospect of reducing greenhouse gas emissions.
But is it also bad for business in that you don't get the benefit of some of this new technology?
Well, I think that's right. You stall progress in the sector. You made a really good point that wind and solar is dramatically dropping in price. We're seeing more and more of it come online into the electricity grids in the country. As you pointed out, natural gas is abundant and cheap now in this country. There's no question that natural gas is substituting in for coal. But the question is, at what pace? Mm-hmm. In order to achieve the kinds of greenhouse gas emission reductions we need to really make progress on climate change, it's not like we can tinker around the edges. You need bold policy that will take all this free, I shouldn't say free, it's just cheap natural gas, but it almost seems free, it's so cheap, that will take it and then build on it and drive us forward to substituting in that cheap natural gas for coal at a much faster rate and doing it more over time and then turning to renewables and adding in more wind and more solar. And you cannot do that with just the market alone at the moment. You need policy to drive that transition position. And what the Trump administration has done is say, oh, the market will take care of things. We believe the market will work. But that's sort of a strategy that's based on a wish and a hope. It's not a climate change strategy.
Kate says, thank you for this incredibly important discussion. Then she goes on to say, we are facing climate collapse, which will end life as we know it. Do you see it that way? That's a pretty dire prediction.
Yeah. Look, there's a lot of very serious impacts that the science tells us we may face if we don't start curbing our greenhouse gas emissions. And all of the recent climate assessments, including the United States government's own climate assessment, this is the Trump administration's own assessment, which they issued last year. They have to put out an assessment every 4 years. Even our own government has said, look, climate change is happening now. It's serious. We're going to see more intense heat waves that are very deadly. We're going to see more erratic weather. We're going to see more wildfires. We're going to see higher sea levels, flooding. All that is true. But I think what I'd like to focus people on is the prospect for actually making progress on this problem. It's not a mystery what we have to do. Right. We know the kinds of things we have to do. We have to clean up the electricity sector. We have to clean up the transportation sector. We have to move forward reversing deforestation. It's not a mystery. There are a bunch of very viable policies we can put in place. What we lack is the political will at the national level to do this. And that's what's so dispiriting about the Trump administration, which is going in the opposite direction after the Obama administration put in place some very ambitious policies. And the other problem we face is Congress. We have a Congress that has simply not been willing to do anything about this issue. And, you know, we used to be the leader of the world. We're the model for the world on environmental issues historically. And we've completely abandoned our leadership on this issue.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Jody Freeman. She's a professor of law, the founding director of the Harvard Law School Environmental and Energy Law Program. She served in the Obama administration in the White House as counselor for energy and climate change. 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@wHYY.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me just pick up on what you said about Congress, and it does feel as if they've been kind of sitting on the sidelines. And it's interesting. It seems like cities, municipalities, and states are leading the charge when it comes to addressing the problems of climate change. Do you think that's because mayors and governors are just so much closer to where people live?
Well, it's interesting. States have always been, there have been a handful of leader states on environmental and natural resource issues forever. And in fact, federal policy has often followed the leading states like California and New York. And that dynamic's a very healthy one historically. What we're seeing now is states like California and New York setting these very ambitious climate policies, you know, saying that they're going to be essentially carbon neutral by 2040 or 2045, saying they're going to have 100% carbon-free electricity by 2045 or 2050. That really charts the path forward and sets an example for the rest of the country. But it's an interesting moment because the federal government, the Trump administration, is really trying to stymie these states in a number of ways that we really haven't seen before. You know, I mentioned that the Trump administration wants to block California's power to set car standards, which it has had historically under the Clean Air Act for decades. We also see the federal government pushing offshore drilling, you know, advancing a very aggressive plan to open up the entire outer continental shelf to drilling, even over the objection of many coastal states, including Republican states with Republican governors, Florida, South Carolina, states that say we don't want this drilling offshore. You see a lot of effort to stymie states that want to go further than the federal government on environmental policy and climate change. And if you add all this together, it's the reverse dynamic compared to what Congress originally put in place in all of our environmental laws, which was to say the federal government sets the floor, the basic standards for environmental quality, air pollution, water pollution, et cetera, and the states can go further. We want to enable the states to do more. Instead, the Trump administration is trying to disable the states that want to be leaders and support the states that want to be laggards.
It seems, at least early on in the Trump administration, the courts really sided with critics of the Trump administration who wanted to undo some of these environmental regulations. Do you think that's still true today?
Well, it's interesting because the first couple of years, what we saw were these efforts by the Environmental Protection Agency and other agencies like the Department of the Interior to very quickly try to reverse policy that the Obama folks had put in place without following the proper procedure. Mm. So one after another, the court said in scores of cases, wait a minute, you don't get to skip legal procedures and just suspend regulations or ignore regulations or decide not to enforce regulations. So they lost a series of cases because they were sloppy. They made a lot of procedural mistakes, and the courts delivered them the bad news that said, no, you got to do this properly. And it's interesting because this isn't just sort of judges who were appointed by Democratic presidents. It's judges appointed by Republican presidents, Democratic presidents. You know, legal actors, judges do not like it when you skip procedure. So they had to go back and do it properly. What we have yet to see really are decisions about the substance of what the administration is proposing to do. So what we're waiting for is to see the merits of these cases litigated and to see what the courts will do when the administration comes in with their new suite of policies. I will say recently we got a bit of an insight into what might happen. You know, the administration had decided that it wouldn't ban chlorpyrifos, which is this pesticide that causes neurological damage in kids. It's a pesticide that leaves a residue on food. And the administration, the Obama administration, said they would ban it. But then the Trump EPA took over and reversed that decision, said, we're not going to ban it. We're going to allow chlorpyrifos on food. And the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals just recently ordered them to ban it. So we're seeing some sign that there won't be a lot of tolerance for policies that aren't supported by a record or against the science and are bad for public health.
There was an article by a guy named Rod Schoonover, a senior analyst actually in the State Department, but he said the White House tried to block his report on climate change and national security, trying to block his submission of written testimony. I do believe that he got to testify, but he felt as if it was a very sort of shrunken testimony that he gave there. I mean, how much do you think just attacks on climate science or climate scientists, or even just trying to silence some of these scientists, are having an effect?
Yeah, this is certainly a phenomenon. There's an effort across the board to suppress climate science. There are a few things the administration has done that are truly outrageous. I mean, removing academic scientists from their scientific advisory panels on the theory that if any scientist has ever taken an EPA grant, they can't sit on a science advisory panel, and replacing them with more lobbyists from the industries that they're being regulated. Like you said, trying to silence or change the testimony of government scientists or officials, telling scientists in the government not to model long-term climate impacts, like don't even study it, don't tell us what could happen, and telling staff at certain agencies not to mention climate change, removing climate change from websites. I mean, these are real shenanigans that the public often doesn't see, but it's an effort to really change what the public knows, limit what the public learns about climate change, and it's really nefarious. It's part of a program I think the administration has adopted that amounts to trying to incapacitate some government agencies. And they're doing this in a variety of ways that are quite invisible to the public. You know, reassigning senior career officials with a lot of expertise into roles where they don't have expertise, moving offices across the country, which will only sow confusion and inspire people to resign because they're not at a certain stage of career, going to move their whole family across the country. All this stuff's going on in the bureaucracy that amounts to kind of dismantling the capacity of agencies that day in and day out really protect the health of the American people. So it's very, very dispiriting.
But I wonder if they're up against, they meaning the Trump administration is up against reality, and that, you know, we're living through these environmental extremes, through unbelievable rainstorms and hurricanes and droughts and heat waves.
Yeah, I think that the impacts of climate change are becoming more accessible, more relatable to people because they look at heat waves and they say, oh, I guess that's what they're talking about when they say the future will bring more of that. And we see this in Europe at the moment, all around the country. And they look at hurricanes and they say, oh, when scientists talk about more intense hurricanes because of warmer seas, I guess this is the kind of thing that could happen. And as tragic as these events are, they are helpful in the sense of bringing home that these effects are here now and they could grow worse in the future. So it's important. It's hard with this issue. It's a more abstract issue than some other environmental issues. And so I think that people are starting to recognize it's a serious long-term problem that we need to start dealing with now. And it's less expensive to start dealing with it now. You know, the recent climate assessment the U.S. government put out said that it could be $500 billion a year in cost to the U.S. economy by the end of the century if we don't start investing in mitigating climate impacts now. So it's either pay now or pay later, and it's smarter to pay a little bit now.
We're almost out of time here, but is it too soon to tell whether by trying to roll back some of these regulations, we've got dirtier water, dirtier skies, more pollution under the Trump administration? Can we say that?
Yeah, we can't say yet all of the effects, but I can tell you, you know, we have this tracker. If you plug in Harvard Law Tracker, it'll come up where we track all of these regulatory rollbacks. And in fact, we track all the other trackers that people have set up to monitor what the Trump administration is doing on science and what they're doing across the board in the bureaucracies. And what you see is an across-the-board attack on basic public health protections. There are weakening rules on dumping coal ash. There are weakening rules on protecting the public from pesticide contamination. They're reversing decisions about protecting streams and waterways from dumping mine waste. They're cutting back on Clean Water Act authority to protect wetlands. And they're opening up areas for leasing against the wishes of even the governors who don't want it. I mean, so we can't see all the measurable impacts, but you can see a very clear trend, which is a comprehensive rollback of environmental protection across the country.
We're almost out of time here, Jody, but do you have some confidence that we will address this problem?
You know, I do. I remain optimistic, even in the face of this, because a lot of these policies, of course, most of them are regulatory. It means that a president can change the direction. And so if there's a new administration in after the next presidential election, you'll see many of these policies going back, I think, toward a better direction of more environmental protection, more respect for science and integrity, positive pathway for climate change. But the better thing would be to have the United States Congress start to modernize our environmental laws, bring them up to date, and adopt a comprehensive approach to climate change.
Well, Jody Freeman, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You're very welcome. And she joined us from the NPR studios in Culver City, California. She's founding director of the Harvard Law School Environmental and Energy Law Program. After this very short break, we'll be talking about plastics, what to do about it. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Now from the fight over environmental regulations to plastics. The typical American uses something like 185 pounds of plastic per year. According to National Geographic, only 9% of plastic in the world is recycled, much of it ending up in the ocean. But even if you are a conscious recycler of plastic, China's refusal to accept it has created a problem of where it all goes. One solution is to reuse plastic bags and bottles and other products. Another is not to use plastic in the first place. Some states and municipalities have banned certain plastic products. In fact, on Monday, Delaware Governor John Carney signed legislation banning plastic bags from large retail stores and chains beginning January 2021. We asked Deanna Cohen to join us. She's a visual artist, also CEO and co-founder of the Plastic Pollution Coalition. And Deanna Cohen, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. Thanks, Marty. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. Let me just give out the phone number and ways that people can join our conversation. It's 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Well, I got up this morning thinking about plastic, knowing, Deanna, I'd be talking with you, and I began with the toothpaste in my plastic tube. I'm sitting here in a studio. I've got my plastic chair. I've got my two screens here that are encased in plastic. I've got phones. I've got my headphones. We live in a world just bathed in plastic.
True. True, we do.
And we do in many ways because it has been cheap. It's been lightweight. It's been convenient. It has given us all this access to these materials that we use every day.
True. I mean, plastic is a pretty miraculous material. And I think where we ran into, where we took the wrong fork in the road was about 50 years ago. When
the
we
plastic
really
fork in the road, right, yes.
Yeah, plastic fork in the road is when we started thinking about it with and designing with it as a, like, with intended obsolescence. So really thinking of it as something that, that could be used to pack it the way that we now package food and beverages and beauty products as a single-use item. And that's where we really took a wrong turn with this material.
Well, I wonder, too, the fact that China has said, look, we're not going to take your bunch of other recycled materials, but certainly plastic materials. That has really thrown a monkey wrench into I think, how we think about plastic.
Well, I think what the China sword did, and that was in 2018 when China said, look, we're producing enough of our own stuff. We don't need to take yours back anymore. What they did is they kind of lifted the veil. So it's a little bit like the Wizard of Oz. You pull the curtain up and you realize that we were, the United States and other countries and Western countries were shipping a lot of their plastic packaging and packaging materials back to China, back to Asia to be processed, or I'm putting recycles in air quotes right now.
Yes, I see that.
But what was actually happening is a lot of that was being landfilled, which is really just being buried in a hole in the environment, so dumped in the environment, or waste energy or incinerated. Waste energy is just kind of a euphemistic way of saying we're burning something. So it's, you know, since the China sword was passed, what it's allowed us to all take a look at is, you know, how much waste are we actually and how much plastic pollution specifically are we really creating, and what kind of models or infrastructure support management of that packaging and of that material.
Well, let me ask you some personal questions. You are a visual artist, and I wonder, you were also co-founder of the Plastic Pollution Coalition. Since that time, how much have you been able to rid yourself of the plastic products that you've used?
So it's a daily challenge for me. Just for background, I've been making artwork out of plastic bags that I cut up and sew back together for almost 30 years, and I show those pieces in galleries and foundations and museums around the world. And I really started working with the material as a kind of celebration of it because it was so ubiquitous and it came in all of these fantastic colors with interesting images and text printed on it. But in working with the material, I began to learn things about it. And one is that some of it photodegrades or heat degrades and breaks apart. And I thought that that meant that it was organic and ephemeral, but in fact, it's just breaking apart into smaller bits. So when we talk about microplastics and what's happening with plastic in the world around us, that's one of the biggest problems, is that plastic is this incredible material, and some of it's going to last forever. A plastic water bottle is potentially going to last 3 or 4 human lifetimes.
Wow.
But, you know, other bits of it break into smaller pieces, but it's not actually breaking down. And a lot of it is getting into the environment, you know, either on land, in our rivers, in our lakes, in our waterways, and it's being ingested by all of the wildlife and coming back to us again, or it's being incinerated and it's coming back to us as particulate pollution. So it's interesting because I was just listening to the guest that you guys had on before, and when I think about climate change, you know, plastic is primarily made from petroleum, and a lot of people don't know that. And it's made from petroleum, and then other chemicals are added to it. Those chemicals have been identified as endocrine disruptors, phthalates and bisphenols. So they're bad for human health. They're bad for animal health. And then we're using petroleum, which is this finite material, byproducts of processing petroleum. So if we want to address what's happening with climate change, one of the ways that we as individuals can do that and also, you know, collectively in communities is by reducing our use of this material.
Well, let me ask you about a couple of things. I was reading in preparation for the show that Americans, all Americans, use something like, I had to write this down and double check it, 100 billion, that's with a B, bags of plastic bags every year. So can we just start there just to say, and I mentioned the fact that the governor of Delaware just signed a bill essentially banning plastic bags from some, you know, large retailers and chain stores. But can we just start there?
Yeah, I mean, so like I said, the primary, you know, plastic is primarily made from petroleum. It's estimated that about 8 million metric tons of plastic enter the ocean annually. in the last 70 years on the planet, we have produced 8.3 billion metric tons of plastic. Plastic's largest market is single-use packaging. Like I said, a lot of it for food and beverages and beauty products. And then also like all kinds of electronics and everything that might already be made out of plastic. And then it comes in all these plastic clamshells and plastic packaging. And plastics are a source of greenhouse gas. So they really are contributing to climate change.
So is it a matter of changing consumers' behavior, or is it a matter of putting pressure on companies to not use so much plastic in their packaging?
I think it's a matter of both. I think that it's really important to raise awareness and educate the public, and particularly young people, because of there are these health implications of using this material the way that we're using it. So that's the first thing, would be like collective behavior change. But it's also important to engage with our places of work, our schools, and then we're also having wonderful conversations with companies and businesses, really ones that are, you know, going to become more prominent, and that they're stepping up and rising to this huge challenge, as well as working on policy and legislation. So one of the tools that we've created as the Plastic Pollution Coalition, in conjunction with other coalition members, is a global plastic reduction legislative toolkit. And this allows people to find model legislation and learn how to ban plastic bags in their community and more. So it's one of the tools that we've created that you can find at our website, which is plasticpollutioncoalition.org.
Let me ask you about some people and organizations saying, you know, we need to get rid of plastic bottles, and people should use glass or metal. Even make your own peanut butter, make your own toothpaste, go to the local farmer's market. And that might work for some people, but I think for most people who are busy, they've got jobs, they've got kids, they're, you know, some of them don't have cars. That's really asking too much. What do you think about that?
Well, let's start with the farmers markets, because yeah, I agree. I may have easier access to those than others. I live in Southern California, and I have access to open farmers markets almost every day of the week, all year long. And I know that that's particularly lucky. But if you do have access to farmers markets, even if it's only a particular season, like the summer where you live, or, you know, your summer if you're in the Southern Hemisphere, so it would be our winter up here, it's a great thing to do and cultivate with your kids and with your family, and make it a normal part of what you do every week. And I love going with my own baskets and canvas bags, and I bring small bags with me. I've become friends with different farmers. I ask them if I want to buy hummus or something that's pre-prepared. I ask them, I say to them, if I come next week, or almond butter, would it be possible for you to bring that in a glass jar, or shall I bring you some glass jars? So, I mean, I'm pretty active with it, and right. I like that engagement because it makes me feel connected to my community where I live. And I have particular farmers that I really, really love, like the Finley brothers in Southern California, who grow 12 different kinds of lettuce that all taste different, you know, or Wiser Farms, and they grow these wonderful potatoes and melons. And, you know, so it's, you really get to know people, and you get connected to where your food comes from, which I think is so valuable.
Well, I agree.
So I think that, you know, so I say that to you, then I also understand that it's a challenge for people.
Right,
so,
exactly. I mean, yeah. I mean, not everyone lives in the wonderful part of the world where you live, where
right.
food is so available and so
right.
healthy and so fresh. And I'm just trying to think, frankly, about people living here in the Philadelphia area,
right.
just don't have access to that. And frankly, picking up a jar of peanut butter is going to be the easiest thing for them to do.
So, well, what I would encourage in that case is, if you do have a choice in the markets that you frequent to buy something in glass versus buying it in plastic, I would highly recommend that you purchase things in glass rather than plastic, because the plastic is porous and it has an engagement with the product that you put inside of it. And I know a lot of people are like, well, okay, I'm not supposed to drink plastic bottled water or plastic bottled beverages. I'm going to buy things in aluminum cans. And while that seems like it's a slightly better solution, it's not really, because all of those cans are lined with a plastic coating. And that's made with the same BPA or BPA substitute, this bisphenol A, which has been identified as an endocrine disruptor. So it's that same chemical that's in plastic. So there is a plastic coating in aluminum bottles and aluminum cans and canned goods.
Right, and canned goods on top of that. Let me get a couple of callers. We got some comments as well.
Sure.
Julie from Philadelphia calling us. And Julie, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
Yeah, my name's Julie. I actually have a website, Green Philly, but we also think of a lot about how a lot of these single-use products are only used once, especially with events. So whether you're hosting a dinner party, people will have their paper plates out or plastic cups that often look recyclable or compostable, but in actuality, they can't be due to municipality rules. It's a whole other story. So just one really simple tip is just to serve reusable dinnerware, whether you're having plates or, you know, your silverware and cups is just something that's such an easy swap that people just try to take the convenient way instead.
Well, Julie, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And I wonder, Deanna, too, I know that you've been involved in some festivals and trying to get festivals.
We have.
Use things like steel bottles or, I guess, what, stainless steel?
So I can tell you about that. We've been working on a project for 6 years now with Bonnaroo Music Festival, which is outside of Nashville, Tennessee, and now also with Wonderfruit, which is a music festival in Thailand, who got in touch with us. And it's called Refill Revolution. And the concept behind that, it was a pilot project. We started very small with them. The festival purchased reusable single-walled steel cups with a neoprene strap and a carabiner so that when you don't have a beverage in it, you could just hook it onto your purse or your backpack or your shorts or your jeans and carry it around with you. It's very lightweight, but you always had a cup, which reminds me of like the Renaissance fair when I was a kid, you know, with the water guy walking around filling up the same cup for everybody, like you're in medieval times or something. But you have your own cup, and then with that cup at the festival, every beer, so you bought it with a beer, and it was more expensive than just a beer, but once you owned that cup for 4 days of the music festival, every beer is $1 off, and obviously you could use it for water or iced tea or other drinks that you'd like to buy as well. You wouldn't get the same discount, but I mean, one of the things that a lot of people don't know is that most of these coffee shops, and particularly chains, will give you a discount, and it can be substantial. It can be, I think Starbucks gives 10 cents off only, but Coffee Bean gives 20 cents off, and other places will give up to $1 off if you come in with your own reusable coffee or teacup. So if you're a person who goes to a coffee shop every day or, you know, with a regular pattern, I highly encourage you to invest in a reusable. I use a double-walled steel one, but you can use a ceramic one. You can use glass. You can bring a mug from home if you just don't want to buy anything and want to use your own thing. And a lot of places respect that and reward you for coming in with your own reusable. So it's very important. And what Julie on the call just mentioned is equally important. I think that we've been very heavily marketed to this idea that when we throw a party, we need to go to, I don't know, Costco or somewhere and buy a whole bunch of single-use throwaway crap, basically, you know, to serve our food on, like, plastic utensils and plastic and paper plates, et cetera, plastic cups. And we really encourage people to use reusables and to think reusable instead. So if you're worried about breakage because you're going to be out on the beach and it's the summer, or you're going to be at the lake, or you're going to be, you know, sitting in a garden or a park or a barbecue with your family, I really encourage people to think about reusables that are, you know, won't break, that are stainless steel, that are wood, that are, if you've got to use something that's a single use, then I would encourage paper versus plastic. But, you know, it's great to begin to think reusable again. And for gatherings, you know, if you're part of a, if you're doing something with your church or your synagogue or your mosque, you know, what if all of those places again started using reusables when they, for community events with people? It would be so wonderful, and it's got this kind of love and beauty to it. So I know that might be a big ask, but I really think that we need to begin to shift our thinking and think reusable, not disposable, and whenever possible, feel empowered to refuse single-use things, single-use plastics.
Well, Deanna, we have to leave it there. Thanks for joining us today on Radio Times.
Sure. It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Again, Deanna Cohen, CEO, co-founder of the Plastic Pollution Coalition. She's also a visual artist. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times. You can find out more about the program, download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us.